This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell, but before we get any further, a huge thanks to Jeff for another excellent edition of On The Record. He'll be back next week, but of course you can catch On The Record every weekday here at RTR FM from 9 in the AM. Also thanks to Brianna with the news. I believe she'll be back at 12 o'clock with all your RTR FM news. As I said though, this is the Indie Media Show. And that's all your news, views and interviews from the open publishing wires of the interwebs. And on today's show, we're going to be returning to a guest that we spoke to a few months ago now. And that's Jane Hammond, who's a producer, filmmaker, activist and author. Her new film, Cry of the Forest, is screening as a part of the Revelation Film Festival. It's won a whole bunch of awards and it tells the story of the WA's Southwest Forests and why they need to be protected. But we're going to be speaking to Jane both about the film and its reception, but also it comes at a time when, for the first time in a long time, the state government appear to be wanting your opinion and views on our native forests. A new survey has been released by the state government asking for our citizens' views on this biodiverse hotspot. Of course, this comes at a time when still every day an area of the size of 10 football fields is logged or cleared in the southwest of WA. So particularly, you know, pertinent that we get our views out there to the state government in regard to protecting these forests. And we'll be talking to Jane a bit about that very shortly. We're also going to be catching up with Nicole McEwen. Nicole's from the UWA Guild. As it was announced just last week, I believe, that there's going to be some major cuts to the social sciences at UWA, including the loss of the anthropology and sociology departments. At least 16 staff will lose their jobs. And as I said, yeah, many courses will be cut and that'll have a huge impact on UWA. So we're going to be catching up with Nicole to chat a bit about that and more broadly about some of the restructuring that's occurring across the university sector at the moment. And this is the Indie Media Show. Now, if you're a regular listener to this program or to RTR in general, you'll know that we frequently cover the efforts to protect our state's native forests. An ongoing campaign that's been waged for many, many decades by many, many different people and generations of activists who've often put themselves on the front line, put their bodies on the line to protect our, well, one of the great biodiverse hotspots in the world. We're now joined by Jane Hammond. Jane is a longtime activist, filmmaker, and basically a bit of a local legend who has gotten together with a bunch of people and made this new film, Cry of the Forest. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Jane.
Good morning. Thank you.
Now, I guess we have spoken to you previously about the film Cry of the Forest, but for any listeners that may have unfortunately not heard about the film, can I just start by talking a bit about it? It was quite a quick production, but it's been out a little while now and receiving quite a bit of attention. Can you just tell us a little bit about the film and what was the initial motivation for producing it?
Right. Well, Cry of the Forest is a story about the plight of Western Australia's forests. We're losing them at the rate of 10 football fields every single day. And yet they have this amazing potential and are doing so to draw down and store carbon. So we have this low-hanging fruit, this easy source of carbon absorption, but we're chopping it down at this alarming rate for use in wood chips, firewood, and for charcoal to put in a silicon smelter near Bunbury. So we're absolutely trashing our forests. We're also clearing vast areas for Alcoa to mine bauxite under the world's only Jarrah forest. So we're in this situation in a climate emergency that just makes absolutely no sense. So that's what the film is about. It tells that story from the point of view of the people on the front line and the businesses that are impacted by this ongoing environmental destruction and the wildlife that, you know, really needs that habitat.
There, of course, was a huge campaign in the 1990s and even early 2000s to stop old-growth logging here in WA. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people, even some of our listeners perhaps, think that a lot of the logging has ended. Do you think that's the case? And is that one thing that this film is trying to address and, you know, I guess try and break through perhaps some of the naivety and ignorance that exists in the community?
Absolutely. I mean, I came to this story thinking the same thing, that we'd saved our forests in the early 2000s. And to find that this rate of destruction was still going on behind the buffer as you drive along the beautiful roads of the southwest past the towering carries. It's just a few metres in. These massive machines are just going in there and plucking out trees and trampling everything for this wasteful product. It's criminal, and it keeps on going, and most people, most West Australians are unaware of this, or were so until very recently, because whilst we protected to some degree our old growth forest, it only takes one stump that may have been cut down in the early last century to disqualify 2 hectares of the land that surrounds it from any old growth protection, as does a small bit of dieback. So forests that are really critically important to habitat are falling on these false assumptions that they're degraded.
Mm. And you mentioned there that it's you know, what the forests are actually going to when they're being when they're being cleared is quite wasteful. I imagine many people, you know, while they might be opposed to clearing the forest, they would assume that the wood's being used for timber or for construction, but apparently that is not the case in many examples.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And when I came to this story, that's what I thought too. Oh, you know, we need our beautiful Jarrah timber. But only 15% of the forest that's felled goes to usable timber. The rest is literally up in smoke within a couple of years. It's being turned into these wood chips, very low-grade wood chips that are exported overseas. Jarrah wood chips are used to fire the furnaces of Simcoa so that they can melt the rock. And the charcoal from the forest that they burn in preparation for the Simcoa smelters to make the carbon to go into these throwaway silicon chips. And silicon, we're not short of silicon. The planet, you know, this isn't diamonds and gold or some, you know, powerful mineral that's going to save lives. This is a pretty basic material that we're pulling out from underneath our forests. And it really is no excuse for that in this day and age, particularly since we actually lose money on this industry, which, you know, people are astounded by.
That was going to be my next question. I remember many years ago finding out about the sort of the forest industry in Tasmania and realizing that had been subsidized for many years. But I believe it's very much the same case here in WA and perhaps elsewhere around Australia, that a lot of these timber industries are not profitable.
No, they're not profitable at all. It costs more to pull down a tree than they make selling it. So, you know, we have to ask the question, why would we continue with such a wasteful taxpayer-subsidised industry when we have a burgeoning plantation industry, and that plantation industry is already supplying nationally, the plantation industry in Australia is already supplying more than 80% of the wood that we use. So, you know, the usable timber that we use. So why would we chop down our native forests when they offer us this fantastic opportunity to draw down and store carbon and to protect biodiversity and to protect the industries that rely on the forest, the ecotourism industries, the mountain biking and the beekeeping. These industries that can be sustainable and can provide lots of jobs.
We're speaking to Jane Hammond about her new film, Cry of the Forest. Jane, the film has been out for a while now, and it's been screened in many, many places, and I believe it's received quite a decent reception. Can you tell us a bit about that, and in terms of how people have responded, or what feedback you've received from people, especially perhaps some of the people you wouldn't expect to have been affected by it?
Absolutely. Yeah, the film came out on November the 1st last year, so it seems like a long time, but it's only been, about 7 months. And it's been doing many, many cinema screenings. They're all organically organised. There was never a theatrical release. This is very much a low-budget production put together, funded completely by generous donors, people putting in $50, $20, $5, a few thousand dollars. So it had it's a different model to some bigger productions. So it's been seen in 25 film festivals around the world. It's been selected for. It's won, picked up a couple of awards. Most recently, on the weekend, we were screening at the Revelation Perth International Film Festival, which was an incredible joy to be part of that wonderful festival. You know, it was a pretty difficult time for the festival with COVID and the restrictions that they've only just been lifted today, just as the festival finished yesterday. But yeah, it's engaging audiences. People come out and they want to act, they want to do something, and we give them a list of suggestions of things that they can do to contact their MP and to start talking about this issue. And it really crosses all political boundaries, it crosses all demographics. People love their forest and they want to see it protected.
Now, talking about something that people can do, and I think, it's quite significant that the state government is asking for people's opinions at the moment. They've put out a survey on native forests and native forest logging. I guess it does seem kind of strange that the state government is actually paying attention, because, after many, many governments that have just been continuing native logging in one form or another, it does seem as though they're starting to actually to sit up and listen to the people. Can you tell us a bit about this survey and I guess, the significance of it?
Yes, the state government is hearing the calls, the massive calls for change in this industry, particularly over the last couple of months. And so we have this new and quite wonderful, it appears, Environment Minister in Amber Jade Sanderson, and she's come out and publicly stated that she wants to hear the voices of the people on this particular issue, because prior to the election, we were told by the government that they're not hearing enough voices on this issue. People don't know it's happening, and they take that as, the government takes that as, nothing's happening and people don't really care. But people do care, and when they find out what is happening in our forest, they have been reacting. And so the government has released this survey, which is the first step in the development of the new forest management plan, a 10-year plan that will dictate really what we do with our forests over the next decade. And so the aim really would be to change that from a where we're going to log and when we're going to log and which part of the forest will fall, to one that says which part, how much can we conserve, how can we protect our forest, how can we manage it better for all people in Western Australia, not just a few logging interests. How can we do that? So this is where we now have a say in this. We can guide the government's thinking in this way by hopping online and going to their WA Forest Survey. Now, there is a BitLink to that to make it easier for people to find, because it's quite a long URL. And that BitLink, which is a tiny URL, it's bit.ly/WA Forest Survey.
Awesome.
People can click on that, and please have your say, because the more people that engage with this and tell the government really there is no room anymore for logging our native forests. The government tells us, and the Forest Products Commission tell us, it's only 1% of the forest, but that 1% is 10 football fields every single day that is falling to these logging machines as they bulldoze their way through our forests.
And I believe those details are also available on the WAFER website, what we'll give out just in a little bit. But just finally, Jane, returning to the film, if people haven't seen it and they want an opportunity to see it, where is the best place for them to do that? I believe there is a screening coming up at the end of this month.
Yeah, that we're screening it in the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival at the end of this month, but early next month, on August the 2nd, there's a screening at the Windsor in Nidlands. And tickets are still available for that screening. That would be a perfect opportunity to come along and find out what you can do. Often we'll do a Q&A after the screenings, and we'll have little stalls there with WAFER, a WAFER. So there's many opportunities. You can jump online to crytheforest.com.au, find out where your next screening is, go to the WAFER website, find out where the screenings are, and download a guide to filling out the survey if you don't want to be caught by some of the more greenwashy questions in there. There's plenty of things people can do, and we really need everyone to engage with this. We really need them to jump on board for the sake of our climate, for the sake of our biodiversity, and protect these beautiful, beautiful forests.
We've been speaking to Jane Hammond, whose new film, Cry of the Forest, is out now. Thanks so much for speaking to us this morning, Jane.
Thank you for that opportunity.
And as Jane said there, you can get along to a few different websites, cryoftheforests.org, but also the WAFER or WAFER website, wafa.org.au. You can find out more information about the film Cry of the Forest there, and you can also find the appropriate links to fill out the survey on our native forests. This is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
You're on the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1 with myself, Raymond Grenfell. Also, Brahma is in the studio. Sorry, she's interrupting me there with a couple of doggy groans. Now, one issue we have covered quite regularly, at least recently on this show, is some of the impacts the COVID-19 pandemic has had on the university sector. There's been a whole bunch of restructuring and job losses across the sector. Just recently, UWA announced some drastic changes to their School of Social Sciences, including dissolving the anthropology and sociology discipline, and that would mean the loss of quite a few staff. To find out about what's happening at UWA, we had the opportunity to speak to Nicole McEwen from the UWA Guild, and I started by asking Nicole exactly what these changes mean for the university, its staff and students.
Well, I think it'll have a really atrocious impact on all of us. I know for the postgrads, which I'm one of, it means losing our supervisors, losing, our networks, losing our whole future, basically. For the undergrads, it means suddenly, a year or two into their degrees, they're being told that it's not going to exist anymore. So obviously that's quite drastic. And then for the staff, I think it's the most horrifying. People have sunk years of their lives into the research and work that they do through anthropology at UWA and through the social sciences. And to just suddenly be told, in 2 weeks, none of this is going to exist anymore, I think is quite horrifying. It's really, really detrimental to all of us. And then, you think about the broader kind of society. This is one of the only places that does social science research in the state. So it's basically saying to future people, well, you can go over east. If you, have these questions, if you want to interrogate the world and think critically about, everything from the existence of racism and the Black Lives Matter movement to climate change and the movements around that to, all of the different things, income inequality, all of the things that we sort of question. It's basically saying, well, who cares about any of that? It's just leading to the further corporatization of our university. No one wants a society where the only things that can be researched and looked into are what's useful for mining corporations. So it's just really detrimental, I think, to all layers of society and our community, and specifically, the lives of the people who are directly impacted, the students and staff.
Now, these cuts are very much tied into broader, cuts in the university sector. and the universities are very much justifying these cuts as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and a need to restructure and to undergo huge job cuts and restructures in that context. As you said there, this is obviously going to impact on the staff and student body, with at least 16 academic jobs going, potentially others as well, and of course all the casual and sessional staff as well. How's the process been so far in terms of, you know, how did the, you know, I guess the university, how are they handling this in terms of negotiating with staff and students?
Basically, this proposal just came out of the blue. No one was consulted or anything in the lead up. A change proposal was just put out, and the legal process is that you have 2 weeks to respond to that officially. So it's been, you know, quite a stressful period for everyone. And I think, yeah, the university hasn't really considered or put any thought into what this means for anything but the sort of bottom line, really.
Certainly. And I guess, as I said, it is happening in the context of, I guess, universities justifying restructures in regard to the impact the COVID-19 pandemic has had on the, I guess, the sector more broadly. However, of course, this has been ongoing for a long time, really, the impacts of neoliberalism and, as you said earlier, the corporatization of universities. There's very much, you know, these sort of things aren't that surprising, unfortunately. I mean, how do you think this ties into that real push towards sort of corporatization of universities and just these, I guess, these sort of major changes that have happened over the last couple of decades in which university staff and students don't have the same protections or rights as maybe they once did?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a real deepening and furthering of the sort of trends we've seen throughout the neoliberalisation of higher education for decades, and then particularly, obviously, recently. You know, there's that saying, never let a good crisis go to waste. I think that's basically how the universities across the country have approached the COVID-19 situation, you know, at a time when more than ever, like, research needs to be done into, you know, the social impacts of something like COVID-19, they're sort of cutting back on that. And the whole framing across the country, the thing that's coming from the Liberal government is, if your university education isn't directly profitable, isn't directly going to lead you into a job in a sector that is particularly profitable, and in WA we always know that's mining, then basically it's not worth it, it's dead weight, and it should be cut or severely reduced. So, yeah, I think that's what's happening across the whole country. And I think that's, you know, it's not just bad for the social science students, it's bad for our whole society that these sort of corporate interests are what dictates our education and our learning. So I guess part of this is obviously to save anthropology and save the social sciences from this direct attack, but also, yeah, I think seeing it connected to all of that stuff is really important, that there needs to be a broad fight against the entire way that universities are being restructured today.
Totally. And I guess talking about that fight, we have seen a little bit of a resurgence of student activism in the last months or even years, really, especially, I guess, around some of the attacks on, you know, like we're talking about restructures and so forth, and also the attacks on staff. We saw a bit of a casuals campaign be kicked off by the NTU, and we've seen a few student strikes and teaching staff and students working together to fight back and to try and challenge some of these attacks. I guess things aren't perhaps as active or radical as they once were on campuses, and many of our listeners will remember the early 2000s and late 90s when there was a huge kind of student activist culture and a lot of activity and action on campus. But do you foresee that things are building in terms of students and staff working together to resist some of these attacks and restructures?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's necessary that that happens. I think, you know, harking back to the 2014 anti sort of, you know, Tony Abbott cuts, or the early 2000s, or even, you know, think about the 60s and 70s and the kinds of student movements that existed then. All of those, I think, are really important inspiration for us today. it's been really heartening. Like the moment that people found out about this, you know, petitions started going up from different sections of the university. People started setting up Facebook pages. There's just been like a nonstop sort of flurry. I don't think I've ever done anything but education campaigning from the moment I found out. And so people are extremely furious at what the university is trying to do and the entire restructure. I guess, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. It's not as though you can just snap your fingers and just will a whole activist campaign into existence. But I think, you know, if our student bodies and the staff groups and things like that, are sort of starting to get together and make those sort of demands on the university, we can start to see a bit of a resurgence of student activism. So, I mean, the first step in that is the stunt we're having on Friday. Yeah.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that and what perhaps people can do, whether they're students of UWA or just more broadly supporters of, the social sciences being in our universities.
So people can definitely come along to the stunt on Friday at 2 p.m. Outside Winthrop Hall at UWA. There's a few different things going around. So you can follow the UWA Education Action Network on Facebook, and you can also go to savesocialsciencesuwa.net to just stay up to date with the campaign, sign the petition, and we're also putting a call out for personal statements. Whether you're a community member, a student, a staff member, an alumni, someone who's, you know, done research in this area in general, no matter what university you're at, even if, you know, you're listening from the other side of the world, all of those statements really matter, both in terms of, you know, encouraging us, but in terms of showing the university that there's really broad outrage about this issue. So, that website, savesocialsciencesuwa.net, is where you can submit those statements, and the UWA Education Action Network on Facebook is where you can sort of stay up to date with all the social media updates and events that are popping up.
Fantastic. And I was just going to say quickly, Nicole, before I let you go, I mean, these attacks are you know, obviously going to have a huge impact on UWA and on social sciences at UWA, and particularly, of course, on the staff and the students that are currently enrolled in those courses. But it really appears to be a bit of a tip of the iceberg. I mean, do you foresee other attacks coming at UWA or in the university sector in general, as we sort of see more of this restructuring in response to, or supposedly in response to, the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing you said, tip of the iceberg, is an apt metaphor. The other one that a couple of staff have been saying to me is, we're just the first on the chopping block. And I think that's really true. The university has, you know, when they first started to restructure, they said, we want to save $70 million annually. And the majority of that, unfortunately, is going to come from squeezing students for every dollar and from, you know, cutting staff as much as possible. So one of the things they want to do is double the class sizes in social science so that the student-to-staff ratio is 35 students for one staff in a class. It's currently like 18 to 1. So there's things like that that are just about, you know, squeezing as much profit as you can out of every class. You can imagine that being rolled out across all sections of the university. And then in addition to that, I mean, 16 social science staff are going to get sacked. There's already also been job losses announced in the library, in the media and marketing department, and I think to come probably in every department. I think the total is, you know, upwards of 500 jobs probably are going to be lost through this restructure. So social sciences is definitely the very tip. And I think that's why our campaign at the moment matters so much, because if you care about any section of the university, really, this is about, you know, putting a student fighting foot forward and saying, if you try and attack us, you're not going to just get away with it without resistance. So it's sort of setting the tone for, I guess, the future of how we're going to respond to all of these horrific cuts and how we want our universities to look in the future.
Totally. And just finally, Nicole, I guess looking at that, if the UWA, if UWA or universities want to save up to, you know, $70 million a year, I guess to play sort of devil's advocate, people would say, well, you know, there needs to be some kind of restructuring or there needs to be some sort of changes in order to do that. However, I imagine yourself and the Guild and certainly, you know, organizations such as the NTU would have other ideas as to how that money can be saved, and perhaps looking at some of the paychecks of the upper management, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favourite chants from some of the rallies we've had previously is the only cut we want to see is Amit Chuckner's salary. I think that really encapsulates it. You can't sit on over $1 million a year and expect that everyone just sit by while you slash and burn and butcher the education that we receive. So I think that would be important. You know, the executives get $10,000 bonuses. There's a lot of money in this system. It's a highly profitable system. And yeah, I just think there's a lot of ways that you can take, you know, save money that don't come from the staff and student experience and rights, basically. So yeah, I think start with Amit Chuckner's salary. And, you know, things like huge marketing campaigns and just wasteless expenditure. Yeah, I think there's a lot of places this money can come from that isn't the sort of very core of, like, what our university is, which is the staff and students that make it up.
That was Nicole McEwen from the UWA Student Guild speaking to us a little earlier today. This is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. This is the Indie Media Show. My name is Raymond Grenfell, and it's now time for a bit of indie media news. In Haiti, two Haitian Americans are among 17 suspects arrested over Wednesday's assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Haitian authorities said a team of 28 heavily armed assailants, 26 of whom were Colombian, carried out the operation. They said at least three suspects were killed and eight remain at large. Colombia's defense minister confirmed some of the men are former members of Colombia's military. One of the two U.S. citizens arrested is Haitian-American James Soligas, the head of a maintenance and repair company in Florida. Little is known about their second Haitian-American suspect, Joseph Vincent, from the Miami area. And the U.S. twice supported coups that removed Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide from power, first in 1991, then again in 2004. And it's still unclear who is currently in charge of Haiti. Shortly before his assassination, Moise announced plans to install a new prime minister to replace interim premier Claude Joseph. The two men are now claiming to be prime minister. The government of the Southern African nation of Eswatini, which was formerly known as Swaziland up until 2018, is brutally cracking down on the largest anti-government protests in the country since it became independent from Britain 53 years ago. Eswatini, bordered by Mozambique and South Africa, is currently facing an economic crisis with a shortage of gas, food and other resources. More than half of Eswatini's citizens live in poverty, while King Mswati III is known for his lavish lifestyle, including owning expensive cars. Amnesty International reports at least 20 protesters have been killed by state security forces and dozens of others tortured, detained or abducted. And in Spain, Spanish police have arrested three suspects connected to the beating death of a young gay man, whose killing set off massive protests in Madrid, Barcelona and other cities across Spain. 24-year-old nursing assistant Samuel Luez died after he was beaten near a nightclub early on Saturday, a week ago, in a town in northern Spain. One of his attackers was heard shouting a homophobic slur. The killing brought tens of thousands of demonstrators into the streets less than a week after Spain's annual Pride celebrations. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have destroyed homes in a Palestinian Bedouin community for the seventh time since November, claiming they were built without permits. A Palestinian Authority official said Wednesday's demolition left dozens of people homeless, including 35 children. And the United Kingdom's High Court has granted the Biden administration the right to appeal a lower court's ruling blocking the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States. This comes as the Wall Street Journal reports US officials have given assurances to the UK that Julian Assange wouldn't be held in a supermax prison if extradited to the US. Last Wednesday, Assange's fiancée, Stella Morris, called on the Biden administration to end its pursuit of Assange. Assange faces up to 175 years in prison in the US for violations of the Espionage Act related to the publication of classified documents exposing US war crimes. And finally, staying in the US, at least one person was killed and several others injured last Wednesday after Tropical Storm Elsa made landfall on Florida's northern Gulf Coast. The following weekend, Elsa crashed through the Caribbean. Elsa crashed through the Caribbean, killing at least three people and causing major damage to homes and other buildings. California is bracing for dangerously high temperatures, with a heat wave forecast to bring highs of 115 degrees Fahrenheit, about 50 degrees Celsius, in the Central Valley, and more than 120 degrees Fahrenheit to some desert areas. This comes as new data from North America shows that North America just experienced the hottest June ever on record, with temperatures averaging more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. So on that cheery note, it's about all we have time for this week's edition of the Indie Media Program. Of course, we'll be back next week at 11 a.m. But as we say every week on the Indie Media Show, don't hate the media, become the media.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?